Radio.
Religion and Terrorism, a talk by Professor Matthew Ogilvie for the Dawson Society.
Thank you so much, Tom. That's a really hard act to follow. I think Tom's given a better lecture than I ever could. And Jingping Wong, one of our tutors at Notre Dame, warned me that I'm being tested by the music stand here tonight. What Tom said was actually quite important. In Western society in general, and I will generalise, but I'm right, for a long time we did not take religion seriously in the public sphere. And there have been many effects of that, but one of the effects of not taking religion seriously was what happened on September 11th, 2001. It bit us again in Bali, on the USS Cole, and in other terror attacks, which were actually a result of not taking religion seriously. There have been other things which have happened as a result of not taking religion seriously. We had the scandalous treatment of prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, which basically was a result of poorly trained military and other personnel who didn't know how to deal with religious terrorists or those suspected of being religious terrorists. The result of that, and this is actually not part of my script, but I'll talk about it very briefly, is that American interrogators for years have been trained according to certain manuals, the Kubark manual of the Central Intelligence Agency and the US Army Standard Interrogation Manual, which identified personality types and the way that you corrupt these personalities. So if you capture a Cuban or a Soviet soldier, you'd identify which personality type they were, and you'd bring them over, you'd flip them by threatening them with death, with violence, not seeing their family, others, the $1 million in the Swiss bank account and the condo in Miami would work. And what happened was that they discovered with using these techniques, 95% of captured Eastern Bloc prisoners would roll over very quickly. When they were dealing with religiously motivated people in Iraq, however, and in Afghanistan, it was the opposite. 95% would not roll over, 95% would resist. Because what happens, you know, when you say to someone, and, you know, this is against the Geneva Convention, but it happens. You know, if you don't cooperate, you'll die. You say that to a Soviet guy, and he doesn't want to die. But save it to an Al-Qaeda agent? Allah be praised. I'm going to go and get my virgins. Okay? You won't see your family again. Inshallah, it's the will of God. I will not torture you because it's illegal, but the man in the next room, he is not so ethical. Inshallah, bring it on. The more torture, the more reward I have in the next life. The result of that, and I'm not condoning the violence and the mistreatment at all, was people who didn't know how to interrogate prisoners properly because they didn't take account of their religion, was that they resorted to illegal and immoral and inhumane ways of dealing with the prisoners. Now, contrast that with people who have taken religion seriously. I'm thinking of when the Israelis captured Sheikh Yassin, who was one of the founders of Hamas. And maybe in a future talk I could talk about this. But through understanding the man's religion, understanding his motivations as a devout Muslim, the man who interrogated him was able to get, and this wasn't a foot soldier of Hamas, but one of the founders of Hamas, one of the leaders, got him to reveal the name, the real name, the code name, the address, the position, and the role of every active Hamas agent at the time. Why? Because this guy and his agency took religion seriously. When Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the former number two of Al-Qaeda, was captured, he was waterboarded. That's a form of enhanced interrogation. I call it torture. And gave up nothing. But when a CIA agent who took religion seriously because he was a devout Catholic, who knew nothing about interrogation and nothing about terrorism, was told, look, you go in and talk to him. Started engaging the faith of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed then essentially wrote the 9/11 report because his religion was being taken seriously. So these things are important. And that's essentially where I fit in. As Tom pointed out, in 2008, I was privileged to be made a fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Part of that was a study tour of Israel to study counterterrorism. I have to clarify that sometimes. Someone said, I went to the Middle East to study terrorism. And people get funny ideas. But since then, I've kept up my contacts with the professional communities in Israel, the United States, and Australia and elsewhere. And one thing that I become more and more convinced of is the need to engage not just the psychology of these folks, the sociology, the economic background and all that, but if we don't understand their religion, if we don't do that, then this war, unfortunately, is going to go on for another 100 years, and I don't want my kids fighting that war. Before I sort of get to the script, a couple of ground rules. Today I'm going to talk about terrorism, not politics. So if you've come here to sort of argue about what my grandfather did to your grandfather, we're not going to have that conversation. I've got to clarify that. I am going to talk about radical Muslims, but I want to clarify, I'm talking about a small minority. I once had a complaint made about me that I said we've got to exterminate 100 million Muslims, and I thought, I never said that. Someone, yes, you did, last night at the talk in Dallas. I said, I didn't. I said, well, were you there? No, I wasn't, but I know someone who was. I thought, oh dear. But the reality is, and I emphasize this, that the majority of victims of Muslim terror are not Jews or Christians, but the reality is that most victims of radical Muslim terrorism are actually fellow Muslims. And something that really helps, and I'll give a shout out to my son, John, who's, put your hand up, John. John's a bit shy. He took me to see Lone Survivor on Friday night. I don't know if you've seen it, and don't go out and see it just because I've said I've seen it, because it is to special operations what The Passion of the Christ was to the story of Jesus. So it's a gut-wrenching movie. But at the end, and I'll try not to spoil it for you if you are going to see it, you've got the Taliban who are basically... is this being recorded? Okay, the Taliban are... Well, there's no Taliban who are going to listen to this, so they're pieces of slime, okay? They follow what I would regard as a heterodox form of Islam, and they're the bad guys. They're the bad guys in reality, they're the bad guys in the movie. However, has anyone seen the movie? Okay, at the end, you've got the Pashtun community who are the good guys, and they do some amazingly wonderful things. And if you read the real story and not just the Hollywood version, you see that they've got hospitality as a great virtue, courage, giving asylum even to an enemy, and protecting your guest even at the peril of your own life. And that's Islamic. And I was explaining to John, because, you know, John's very interested in these issues, I said the beauty of this film at the end is you see the ugly side of Islam and you see the beautiful side of Islam. And the beautiful side is actually the majority. And I say to folks sometimes that we've got to realise that before they hijacked the jetliners, Al-Qaeda hijacked Islam. So, it's a pity I've got to spend time saying that, but I just don't want to be misunderstood. So let's talk about it. Through history, and Tom actually made this point already, so you know, where's Tom? You stole my thunder. But the reality is that through history, most terrorism has been religiously motivated. We find it in the Bible. Like, we've got the zealots, who were basically the terrorists of their time. They would, perform an assassination in the public square, even before we call them assassinations, do it in spectacular style, then melt into the civilian population. The people who gave us the word assassin were a Muslim sect of the Hashashin, and people debate whether they were sellers of hashish or whether they partook of hashish before a killing. But they had something to do with hashish anyway, which, in that part of the world is quite normal. And what they would do is they would get collaborators or evildoers in their eyes. The Hashashin fellow would sneak into the chamber of the bad guy, assassinate him, and then allow himself to be killed by the guards, martyring himself and being sent straight to Allah. Within Hinduism, there are the people who gave us the word thugs, the thuggee, who practiced a religious killing as a devotion to their goddess. And up until about the 20th century, most terrorism was actually religious for one reason or another. Last century was a bit of a blip on the radar, a bump in the road. Most terrorist movements became nationalist or political. And even if these movements had a strong religious membership, their primary motivations were not religious, but national or political. So the two most well-known groups, say, for example, and I shouldn't say this in Rosie O'Grady's, but the Irish Republican Army, even though it had a lot of Catholics in it, was not really a religiously motivated group, but it was nationalistically and politically motivated. So it wasn't about establishing a Catholic state. It was about getting rid of the British and other related things. The Palestinian Liberation Organization and its Fatah faction, of which Yasser Arafat was the head, even though most of its members were culturally Muslim, was effectively secular, and its aims were not religious, but rather nationalistic. So in the mid-20th century, none of the international terror groups existing at the time were religious in their motivations. There were two things in our lifetime which really prompted the development of religiously motivated terrorism. The first was the Soviet invasion and the repelling of that in Afghanistan. The other was the revolution in Iran. Now, the response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was crucial to modern radical Islam. It revived a belief in jihad in order to repel an infidel occupier. And the important thing about that was that in the minds of many of the mujahideen was that it became the personal duty of every faithful Muslim to engage in this jihad. It popularized what's called the irreversibility doctrine, and that is that any land that had once been under Muslim control must always remain under Muslim control. So that means Afghanistan, Palestine, Kashmir, Chechnya, parts of Spain. And for the radical fighters in Afghanistan, it was the personal duty of every Muslim to fight jihad to liberate that land. And the message of Islam became radicalized so that the duty to fight jihad became almost like an imperative, no less important than the five pillars of Islam. What happened, of course, was that the Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan. There are a number of rules of war. One of them is you do not invade Russia. That's rule number two. If you're dumb enough to break rule number one, do not invade Russia in the winter. Okay? Rule number three, see rule number one. Rule number four, do not invade Afghanistan. It has not been done successfully since the time of Alexander the Great, and he didn't last long. when the Mujahideen and their allies defeated the Soviet Union, and for a lot of us are young here, but those who are more mature years, remember the good old days of the Soviet Union when we knew how our enemies were? It was basically the Free West and the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union were the big bad guys. What prompted the development of so much modern terror was seen in the perception of these fighters that through the will and the strength of Allah, the evil empire, remember Ronald Reagan referring to them that way? The evil empire had been defeated by the will of God. So this was taken as a sort of apocalyptic sign that the apocalyptic jihad against the infidels would not only defeat one of the two evil empires of the world, but it would result in the rule of Islam in the world. And I cannot emphasize that enough, that with the defeat of the Soviets, radical Muslims were emboldened to embark on what was basically seen as the final battle. One of the fighters there, well, not a fighter, but a facilitator, was a young Saudi multimillionaire worth about $500 million, who established a group, an organization called The Base, which facilitated the bringing in and supplying of foreign fighters. The Base in Arabic is Al-Qaeda, and the young multimillionaire was Osama bin Laden. The other thing that prompted a lot of modern terror was the establishment of the Islamic Republic in Iran on April the 1st, 1979. And I've always wondered why they chose April Fool's Day, but I just say it to upset some people. But within a dozen years of the revolution there, the number of religiously motivated terrorist groups rose from 2 to 11. And the Islamic Republic in Iran has become a major state sponsor of terrorism. I hate statistics, but I'm going to use them. So call me a hypocrite if you want to. But I want to give you a sense of the importance of religion for contemporary terrorism. In 1979, there were basically two religiously motivated international terrorist groups. After Afghanistan, after Iran, in 1994, 16 out of 49 international terror groups were motivated by religion. In 1995, 26 out of the 56 international terror groups were religiously motivated. And in 2004, 52, nearly half of identifiable religious terror groups were religious. So religiously motivated terrorism has been growing exponentially in relation to secular, national, or political terrorism. But more than the number of groups is the effect that's been had, and I'm going to use the statistics a bit more. Between 1998 and 2004, religiously motivated terror attacks constituted 6% of terror attacks, but accounted for 30% of terror fatalities. So in that time, 98 to 2004, a religiously motivated terror attack was on average 5 times more deadly than a secular terror attack. If we look at Shiite groups and Al-Qaeda, Shiite groups were responsible for 8% of international terror attacks between 1982 and 1989, but they caused 30% of all fatalities. Al-Qaeda committed 0.1%, 0.1% of terror attacks between 1998 and 2004, but these attacks caused 19% of terrorist fatalities in that period. This is a key feature of religious terrorism I might talk about later. But essentially, if we might compare religiously motivated terror groups and nationalistically or politically motivated groups, I like to quote an IRA fellow who gave a very frank and open interview from jail. And someone was trying to, you know, get into his mind and say, you know, why the killing? And he gave a very Irish perspective on it. He said, look, you've got to understand, we don't kill people for the sake of bloody well killing them. It's got a purpose to it. If you sort of remember the old days, the Irish Republican Army would place a bomb in a pub. sorry, they did it, not me. But what would they do? There's a device at Rosie O'Grady's. You evacuate or people die. People would evacuate. The place would get blown up. People would be terrorized, but usually people wouldn't die. Sometimes it would go horribly wrong and people would die. With the PLO, they would hijack a plane. They would make ridiculous demands. The demands would be whittled down. They threatened to kill people, but normally there wouldn't be so much killing. Everything changed with 9/11. There were no demands made. There was no ransom. There were no hostages as such. It was just about killing as many infidels as possible. The way I like to put it is that for secular terror groups, killing is a means to an end. For the religiously motivated terror groups, killing is not the means, it is the end. It is the very will of God. So what drives this? What's most important about religiously motivated terrorism is the worldview held by these terrorists. Their worldview is formed by an experience of alienation. They don't see themselves as part of this world or part of the order of the world. They experience themselves as rank outsiders. They ultimately don't see themselves as people who are there to correct flaws in the system, but people who believe that the system is absolutely corrupt and damned. And that experience of alienation, you know, whether it's feeling that they are on the outside, whether they're feeling marginalized, or whether they feel superior, is something you see in their rhetoric. The way that they demonize their enemies, they refer to their enemies very often not as, you know, human beings we disagree with, but as subhumans. Their rhetoric calls their enemies dogs, infidels, descendants of monkeys, mud people. And it might be stating the obvious, but the religious mythology that gives rise to that sort of us versus them mentality demonizes other people as less than human, and if they're less than human, they have no human rights, and all forms of terror upon them are permissible. I want to turn specifically to Islamic terrorism because that's the radical Islamic terrorism is the one that affects us the most today. And it's important if we talk about jihad and world conquest. And jihad is misunderstood by two groups: people in the West outside of Islam and people inside Islam. Jihad comes from an Arabic word meaning struggle. It has, and people disagree on this, but I've heard that jihad has 22 or 23 different meanings. It can mean, well, it generally means struggle. And there's talk about the lesser jihad and the greater jihad. The greatest jihad, the greatest struggle for faithful Muslims is on the inside. It is the struggle to overcome what we might call the flesh or worldly desire and to live as a faithful follower of Allah. But then there is the external jihad, which can refer to the military struggle or a form of holy war. There's a generally accepted view in Islam that jihad is obligatory. All Muslims must practice jihad. They must practice the holy struggle. But radical Islam holds that the military jihad is obligatory. And that was something that Osama bin Laden radicalized within his faction of Islam. For many Muslims, engaging in some sort of struggle against infidels was seen as noble, but an option, a vocation, if I could put it that way. But bin Laden radicalized that by saying that the military struggle, the military jihad, is obligatory for all Muslims. And that's actually important because not only was he able to spread his message and say to people, if you're a faithful Muslim, you must do this, but by saying it was compulsory, he demonized those who didn't participate. and said, basically, if you're not practicing our jihad, you are an apostate Muslim. And within Islam, see, Muslims don't call each other apostate. You know, Catholics, we're really good at calling each other heretics, aren't we? I mean, it happens all the time. I've been called a heretic many, many times. It doesn't bother me. You know, sticks and stones, that sort of thing. Within Islam, look, if someone calls me a heretic, what's the worst that can happen? I have a frank and open discussion with the Archbishop. I might get a ticket to Rome. You never know. Okay? I get to meet the Pope. And we work out it's all a big misunderstanding. You know, really, when I was at Rosie O'Grady's, that's not what I meant to say, Your Holiness. Apostasy in Islam carries the death sentence. So if you have been Muslim, but you're no longer a faithful Muslim, the death sentence is upon you. And this is why Muslims don't throw around the heresy thing. Even Shiites and Sunnis, who hate each other with a vengeance, do not call each other apostate. Bin Laden did. If you're not with us, if you're not practicing Al-Qaeda-type Islam, you are an apostate. And this is why there are so many Muslim victims of Al-Qaeda violence. Now, there is a very naive view, I won't say who holds this view, but you'll know, that if we just respect each other, respect each other's boundaries, that we'll all get on. It's all peace, love, and kumbaya. The problem is that for the radical Muslims, it doesn't work that way. There's a key tenet of the radicals that their vision is to bring their form of Islam to the world. An important part of the spread of their faith is the spread of Sharia law, the law which is based on the Quran. There are versions of Sharia operative in Saudi Arabia. Do you know what the constitution of Saudi Arabia is? The Quran. That's their constitutional document. You've got Sharia, another version of it, Shiite Sharia in Iran, and you've got other versions in parts of Indonesia. And in parts of Afghanistan ruled by the Taliban. Now, after the revolution in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini declared his intention to spread the Islamic revolution around the world. And this is a key motivation of Muslim terror groups. They want to see Sharia spread to all Muslim lands. And here's the thing which is a real concern. What do they mean by Muslim land? Is it their own country? So, you know, we find in Egypt, for example, the great struggle, and I'm certainly not going to talk politics here, but I'll just state a matter of fact, that the Muslim Brotherhood wanted to bring Sharia back to Egypt. But what about other parts of the world? There are the moderate radicals, if I can call them that, who want to bring Sharia back to every land ever ruled by Islam. So Israel, Palestine, North Africa, Spain, East Timor. This is why we had so many problems over East Timor. Even though East Timor is 90% Catholic, it had been ruled by Indonesia, a Muslim country. And I'm going to get on my high horse here. Remember when Bali was bombed? And you had all the experts in the media. Is there anyone here from the media? Good. Just, you know, oh, it happened because of oppression and marginalization and because of this social and other thing. What rot? Osama bin Laden clarified what Bali was about. He said it was because of infidels, us, for stealing, and I'm quoting him here, stealing Muslim land in East Timor. I wrote a letter to the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and it actually got published because I said, you know, guys, you're missing the point here. Bin Laden himself, and I would regard Bin Laden as an expert on Muslim terrorism. I could be wrong here. But I said, instead of listening to these very intelligent people, we should listen to Bin Laden. So the moderate radicals want to spread Sharia to every land which was ever ruled by Islam. That's the irreversibility doctrine. The real radicals just want to spread Sharia all over the world, to Australia, America, Britain, everywhere. There's a way of thinking about countries which are not under Sharia, and that is essentially that our governments are illegitimate. And I've got to keep a straight face when I say that, because sometimes I speak where I have issues with the government. But, you know, like, you know, we may love our government, we may not like it, we may have voted for one party or the other, but ultimately we do hold that our government is legitimate, even if we don't like their policies. The radical Islamic idea is that any government which is not based on Sharia is illegitimate. In fact, these governments that don't practice Sharia are contrary to God. They are governments of the shaitan, the devil. And it is the sacred duty of Muslims to fight against these governments. I can quote the former Hezbollah leader, Hussein Mousawi, who said, and I quote him here, "We are not fighting so that the enemy recognizes us and offers us something. We are fighting to wipe out the enemy." If you look at the fatwas of Osama bin Laden, and you know, fatwas are authoritative legal rulings made in Islam, bin Laden was funny because he had absolutely no training and no authorization, but that didn't stop him. You know, as a really good Muslim said to me once, I just wish we had a Muslim pope. Or even, you know, if we had a Shiite pope and a Sunni anti-pope or whatever, at least some authority. Because, so this is, Islam doesn't have that sort of structure. So, you know, there are some benefits to being Catholic. Someone who can just get up and say, this is rubbish. Okay. But whether it's rubbish or not, people followed him. And bin Laden said that this jihad was the personal duty of every Muslim. And the, you know, Islam traditionally divides the Dar al-Salam, the house of peace, because Islam actually does mean the peaceful submission to the word of God. I don't know if you know that, but Islam comes from salam, which is from the same root as the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace. So there's the house of peace, and there's the Dar al-Harb, the house of war, which is what most of us live in. The radicals radicalize that idea, and they basically say there can be no coexistence with the current world. There can be no compromise, no coexistence. And, you know, we might have heard, you know, especially when Khomeini was alive, referring to America as the great Satan. Maybe that, what does that make Australia, like little Satan or something? I'm not sure. But why do they dislike the United States so much? It's because the United States, for greater or worse, embraces pluralism and freedom and the ability of every person to follow their conscience. That is the antithesis to the one religion, one Sharia Islamic dictatorship, which was sought after by bin Laden, Khomeini, and radicals like them. I want to get into some theological stuff now, because I'm a theologian and, you know, I've got to give a plug to my field. How is it, as I saw an interview with a suicide bomber, of course he was a failed suicide bomber. That really came out the wrong way, but they're captured occasionally and interviewed, and, you know, questions are asked, and I'll sort of paraphrase what he said. He was asked, look, you know, what was your mission? And his mission was to go out and to blow up as many people. He had a belt on. Blow up himself with as many infidel, in this case Jewish women and children, as possible. And he was asked, well, you know, is this right? And eventually the interrogator said, you know, how do you feel about it? Oh, it's wrong. It's totally wrong, but it's the will of God. And that really disturbed me. You know, coming from a Catholic sort of background, that's hard to understand. So in radical Islam, the law of Allah overrides human conscience and human senses of morality. In radical Islam, you've got the reverse of what we do. I mean, in our society, civil law is basically the codification of morality. It's like the collective conscience of a people. In Islam, especially radical Islam, it's the opposite. Morality is dictated by law. And when it's the law being mediated by your leader, things that one might find morally repugnant, like terrorism, can be justified and mandated. Within the radicals, there's a radical interpretation of points of theology in the Quran. And I'll quote from Surah 2. Fighting is ordered for you, even though you dislike it. And it may be that you dislike a thing that is good for you and like a thing that is bad for you. Allah knows, but you do not know. And this is repeated in the Quran many times. God knows, but you do not know. Human beings are incapable of having a personal conscience and personal knowledge. When taken in a radical sense, as the radicals do, this reflects a rejection of human conscience. It reflects a rejection of human thinking. Basically, it's belief that human reason is unable to know the will of God, and human reason is unable to know right from wrong. This is a good sort of illustration of this. Shmuel Bar, who is an Israeli scholar who knows Islam better than most Muslims, points this out. In the Jewish Christian Bible story of Adam and Eve, so you've got the two naked people in the garden and the serpent and that unfortunate incident. But they eat the fruit of the tree. And what do they acquire when they eat of the fruit of that tree? The knowledge of good and evil. We've read our Bible. Fantastic. In Islam, in the Quran, it's not the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. It's just a tree. And just a fruit there that is there to test them. And that's sort of a paradigm, if you like. That within the Judeo-Christian tradition, there's an emphasis that people know. And, you know, you get to St. Paul when he said, look, you know, the pagans, even though they didn't know God, their consciences should have convicted them. You don't have the same tradition within Islam. And for the radicals, you know, if you've got someone who's been called up for suicide duty or terror duty of some sort, you say, look, I don't feel good about this. You know, infidel soldiers may be, but women and children, they are taught, do not trust your conscience. Your conscience and your human reason are not a gift of God, but they are the enemies of God. And this means that the radicals are taught not to trust their consciences, not to trust their thinking. And instead of constructing a moral system which is based on inner conscience, the radicals are expected to obey the will of God. But here's the kicker. If you cannot know in your heart of hearts what is right and wrong, if you are taught to mistrust your own thinking, how do you know the will of God? Follow your leader. And this is very important, that you have this authoritarian approach to morality. And it's asked, for example, what happens if one follows a misleading authority? So, you know, if you've got doubts about this suicide mission or whatever, what happens if you do it? Even though you know in your heart of hearts that it's wrong, then the radicals are taught, you're not culpable. The culpability lays with the authority. The other thing that's very important is, you know, we know within our Catholic tradition we're taught that our conscience, you know, and do I have to talk a lot about what conscience is and isn't? So when conscience is well-informed, prayerful, all the stuff that Vatican II really said, not what Vatican II is purported to have said, that the human conscience is basically, as Blessed John Paul II said, the voice of God within us. It's the inner sanctuary of a person where we discern the will of God. The radicals are taught that you cannot know the will of God and that you have to rely on your leaders. And it's effectively what happens is that the radicals have, you know, the old Nuremberg defense, you know, after the Second World War and the Nazis were put up before the Nuremberg trial, and their defense was, I was just following orders. And that was actually part of what prompted Vatican II's statement on conscience. When it said we must follow our conscience, it didn't mean this warm, fuzzy sort of thing. It was a radical statement that we have to do what is right. For the radicals, there is no conscience. There is no knowledge. There is following orders. For the radicals also, the very notion of God is different. Does God command that which is good? No. What God commands are tests, to test obedience. This is why I always found it really freaky that suicide bombers were told that, you know, if you blow yourself up, you know, everyone focuses on the 72 virgins. I've got no idea why. I'll try and quote Hamas here. From the moment the first drop of blood is spilled, the Shaheed feels no pain. That helps if you're going to do that. His reward in heaven is 72 dark-eyed virgins. He intercedes for 70 of his family. That's like a plenary indulgence for 70 of your family. Let's look. You can get onto YouTube and look up Hamas mothers. This Hamas mother, for example, who's sending off her fourth son to blow himself up. Why is she happy? Junior blows himself up. She goes straight to heaven. Intercedes for 70 of their family. He has a crown upon his head with four jewels. Each one is worth more than all the jewels on the earth. It's not a bad deal. But they also get to spend eternity with wine, women, and song. And I'm like, hang on, wine? Drinking alcohol is forbidden within Islam. It's haram. So why do they get to booze up in the afterlife? It's because for the radicals, the will of God in this life is not necessarily what is good for you and what is good for humanity. It's what God has willed that you will follow as a test. Now, this is a radical difference between, you know, what a lot of Muslims believe and certainly what Catholics believe. You know, we're not going to have a life of righteousness in this life for a life of sin in the other. There's this continuity in a God of justice, a God of love, a God who commands not what is just the will of God, but what is good for us, will only command that which is good. There's another feature of radical Islam, and that is its love of death. Remember what I said before, for the political terrorist, violence is a means to an end. For the religiously motivated terrorist, violence is not the means, but it is the end itself. Violence is seen as a duty commanded by God. Another way of putting this is that for the politically motivated terrorist, violence is a necessary evil. For the religiously motivated terrorist, violence is a necessary good, something that embodies and reveals the very will of God. The radical Islamic love of death also relates to an anthropology, and that is this life valuable? And this really hit hard. Remember the bombing of the barracks, the marine barracks in Beirut? A suicide bomber drove a truck into the marine barracks and blew up many Marines. The guy on guard duty who didn't die was haunted by the smile on the face of the bomber. You know, normally, like if I said to, you know, any of us today, I want you to get into suicide duty, somehow convinced you it was the will of God, I mean, would you be smiling? I mean, you probably have me committed, but, you know, would you be smiling at this prospect? A leader, a Muslim leader who certainly was completely anti-terrorist, but said, look, if you step inside this guy's shoes, think of it this way. Imagine that if you'd have been in a hot, dry desert for years, you were parched, dehydrated, and burnt, and someone said, here's a door, and on the other side of the door is a cool shower. Would you not be smiling? And this is why the Beirut bomber was smiling, because basically he's embodying this radical idea that this life is worthless, This life is only a test. There's nothing valuable about this life. The only thing valuable is the next one. And you certainly see this hatred of human life, the lives of others and the life of themselves, which leads to a love of death, the death of others and the death of themselves. They're also taught that putting oneself in harm's way is an act of faith. If a mujahid, a fighter, fights against overwhelming odds, the mujahid is proving his faith. Within traditional Islam, because holy war had been important from the very early days, there are different interpretations of when a fighter could withdraw. Some people said if they were overwhelmed 2-1, they could retreat. Others said 10-1, and they could retreat. But the key thing was that by risking death, one proves one's faith in Allah. But importantly, there's a contrast between the Judeo-Christian worldview. I wish I was a fundamentalist. I could remember which part of the Bible it was. I think it's Deuteronomy. Choose life. Why? Because this life is good. This life is valuable. This life is a gift of God. It's a blessing. If one goes to war and loses one's life, you're losing something good. On the other hand, in radical Islam, this life is not of value. This life is only a test that enables you to enter paradise. And so if you lose your life in war, you're not losing something good. You're relieving yourself of a burden. I want to talk about, how am I going for time? Okay. How long have I got? 10 minutes? Okay. Just a gentle plug. I've actually taught an entire graduate course in religion and terrorism, which if there's sufficient demand, I'll be able to teach at Notre Dame sometime soon. I've got to get it in. Why is it that terrorists can attack non-combatants? And Western law, as we have enshrined in the Geneva Convention, recognises that non-combatants should never be directly targeted. But for the radicals within Islam, there's no such recognition of non-combatants. Shamul Barr, and he's an excellent scholar, puts the point this way in his book on Islamic jihadism, and I'll quote him here. While all those whom it is forbidden to harm are non-combatants, not all non-combatants are immune from harm by virtue of that status. This is because for radical Muslims, whether or not you're allowed to attack people is not, as we would hold, based on human rights. I mean, to attack civilians for us is a violation of human rights. For radical Muslims, there are no human rights. Whether or not you can attack someone is basically founded upon whether they are valuable to the cause or whether they would form a future spoil of war. So in the same way as the radicals are taught, don't attack animals or cut down fruit trees because you can use them later on, they're taught not to attack people who may be useful at some time. So the prohibition against killing civilians, if they're women, children, and the aged, is not a prohibition based on their non-combatant status, but rather upon their ability to fight Muslims. And this is why, this is why we have our 9/11s, our Balis, and our other attacks. It means that people who are non-combatants, civilians, women, and children, can be targeted if they're perceived as threats. And I was sort of agonizing over, how is this justified? And a friend of mine interviewed a Hamas terrorist. And she said to this fellow from Hamas, how come you target Israeli children? He said, it's simple. Israeli children grow up to become Israeli soldiers. Because over there, your gap year lasts for 3 years in the Israeli army, 2 years if you're a woman. She said, all right, what about women? This is easy. Israeli women give birth to Israeli children who become Israeli soldiers. What about 9/11? For the radicals, citizenship in a democracy makes one a legitimate target for the radical Muslims. This is because if we pay taxes, we are financially supporting the effort of the infidels. Or if we express an opinion, I'm in deep trouble. If we vote for a government, we are supporting the infidel government, we're giving support to the enemy, and therefore we are legitimate targets. So that was the thinking in attacks such as 9/11, which were primarily against civilians. I don't have time to talk about Al-Qaeda and the Shiites in Iran, unless we want to talk later. But I want to talk about the future. And I'm a pessimist. You know, some people, you know, they're glass half empty, glass half full people. I take the point of view that we had the wrong size glass to begin with. We've done some good things in the war on terror. We've done some dumb things. And my personal view is that there are pockets of people within the military and intelligence agencies and some politicians who get it, who understand that, you know, who was it who said we have a clash of civilizations? It was Osama bin Laden himself. Who was it who said this is a new crusade? It was bin Laden. But things have changed since 9/11, some of them for the better. If we take Al-Qaeda as an example, the obvious is that they've had a change of leadership. Thank God. But the other more important thing is that Al-Qaeda has changed form from an organization which had a well-defined hierarchy with a large budget to now being a largely ideological movement. So Al-Qaeda doesn't try to do 9/11s anymore, but it distributes literature. I mean, I tell you what, masters of online education, Al-Qaeda and Hamas, they are brilliant at it. But they inspire local movements. The attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, you know, with all respect to certain people in the US government, it was not a film review, but it was an attack inspired by Al-Qaeda. So Al-Qaeda now, rather than giving direct operational support to terrorists, is more likely to be the ideological inspiration for more or less autonomous terrorists. The other thing with the... if my dog hadn't kept me up all night, I'd remember his name, but the new leader of Al-Qaeda as well is very different to bin Laden. Bin Laden was a big guy. He wanted to do big special attacks, which would be on CNN. But they're very expensive. They cost about $500,000 to mount and take many months of training. The new leadership of Al-Qaeda is more into smaller, more economical, but ultimately more effective attacks. With suicide bombers, I've got a particular interest in suicide bombers. They're changing rapidly. In the old days, suicide bombers were people on the margins. They were marginalised people seeking martyrdom as a way out. So when the PLO was using suicide bombers, they'd recruit someone and deploy them within 48 hours. And this is something that the Taliban still does, is they'll get someone who's got trouble, they're unemployed, they're unmarried and pregnant or something like that, and they'll... promise them money, support, ticket to paradise, and deploy them in 48 hours. Hamas, though, which is a movement that I think should be followed very carefully, challenges the stereotypes. Hamas is very careful to recruit only deeply religious young men. Sorry, ladies. These men are neither poor nor underprivileged, nor are they psychiatrically ill. They're stable, devout and well-educated. To become eligible to be recruited by Hamas, you have to have a college education. When they're recruited, they undergo a period of training, not 2 days, but 2 years. And then if they're selected for suicide duty, they're monitored by senior Hamas members to make sure they don't depart from their objective. They then go off, if they're selected, to record the video testament and do what they do. So things are changing from the old days quite rapidly. This is a talk for the Dawson Society, and I'm very grateful for having me here. And I want to talk a little bit about the whole culture and religion bit. And I want to end with a story. And it regards a conversation I've had with a terrorist. Now, it's a matter of fact that I've met victims of terrorism. It's a gut-wrenching experience. I've met the people who fight terrorism, and I have actually met terrorists themselves. I want to tell you about a conversation I had. Now, I can't tell you where this conversation occurred, with whom, or for that matter, if it's true. But let's say I was talking with a terrorist, and I asked him, "What's the most important part about your fight, your jihad?" And he said with great pride, "The most important thing about my jihad is that I believe in God. I believe in Allah." I nodded and I said, "You know, belief in God is important, but it's not the most important issue." And he looked at me as if I was an idiot. And I said to him, "Look, it's not important whether you believe in God. It's important whether God believes in you." And he was curious as to what this infidel meant. So I explained, "Look, so you and I, we both believe in God, the God of Abraham. But we believe in radically different concepts of God. One of us believes in a God who does not value human life, a God who believes that the lives of his followers are disposable and that the lives of infidels are worthless. The other believes in a God who values all human life, who calls his followers to choose life, a God who says that he who saves a single life saves the world entire. One of us believes that in the eyes of God, he has no worthwhile conscience, that God knows, but the person does not know. One of us believes that he has to rely on others to guide his decisions, even if that guidance seems repugnant. The other one of us believes that God has blessed him with a conscience that can guide him to knowledge of right and wrong, and that he is personally responsible for his actions. I added, one of us believes that he cannot know, that his mind is darkened, and that he cannot know truth for himself. The other knows that he has a God-given intellect, and that with it, he can pursue truth and come to knowledge of reality for himself. The man smiled and said, as only a Middle Eastern can say, "Truly, my friend, we are indeed enemies." I think that's a fair statement. The basic disagreement between the terrorist and myself was not about the existence of God. We're both probably equally passionate about the existence of God. It wasn't an argument about the validity of the Quran or the Bible. Our disagreement was about three things: the nature of God, about conscience and ethics, our ability to know truth. That is philosophy. It's my conviction that in the short term, the war on terror will be fought with bullets and bombs. But in the long term, the war will be won or lost in the human mind and the human heart. As long as the radical jihadists believe in a God who despises life, so long as they despair of discerning right and wrong for themselves, and so long as they give up the pursuit of truth, then they will be willing participants in terrorism. There's another perspective on this. I once listened to an experienced agent of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he was asked, "How can we end the war on terror?" And, you know, when you hang around people like this, you get the ones to say, you know, cluster bombs, napalm, interrogations, whips and chains, all this sort of knuckle-dragging stuff. But this guy who had been there, done that, and had experience and knowledge said, "Look, we go to the nations or the regions that support terror, and we do one of two things. First, we can give them all flat-screen TVs. corrupt them with Western values. And just a bit of trivia there. Do you know how Bin Laden started his anti-infidel thing? People think it was when George Bush Sr. put boots on the ground in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden's original jihad was against Western media, Western TV, Western film, Western music, which was an infidel influence in the Arabian Peninsula. So it wasn't George Bush, it was MTV. They have a lot to answer for. So flat screen TVs, corrupt the heck out of them, make them decadent Westerners. Or, he said, we can establish liberal arts colleges. What is the wisdom of that? That through, and you know, not just I've got to be careful, not just standard liberal arts, cafeteria type liberal arts education, but a real liberal arts education that gives a positive view of God, that gives people an ability to know truth and distinguish right from wrong for themselves. It's through those things that terrorism will be defeated. When I heard that, I was reminded that some years ago, before this whole thing became popular, I did some research on racist Christian ideologies. And in the course of that research, I read Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. You know, try being a theologian with the Bible, Mein Kampf, and the Al-Qaeda training manual on your bookshelf. Raises questions. But when I read Mein Kampf, and, you know, it's a repugnant book. It's evil. But you don't understand World War II and contemporary history until you've read it. So it's scary, it's horrifying, but read it sometime. Hitler claimed that the great mass of humanity consists neither of philosophers nor of saints, which to him meant that most people can never access the inner efficacy that a religion can bring. It clarified so much for me. I mean, Hitler was evil, but he was an evil genius. And he knew that because most people didn't pray enough and because they didn't think enough, that the religion of National Socialism would succeed. It led me to the conclusion that Christianity, just as with any religion, can be corrupted through ensuring that people either do not think, do not have a deep spirituality, or even worse, neither think nor pray. And I like to shock people. And what I did when I taught the course on religion and terrorism, and it was at a university with some very serious Catholic thinkers, I asked the students at the end, I said, you've seen the good, the beautiful side of Islam, and you've seen the ugly side. Here's your question and a possible assignment topic. What would it take to corrupt Christianity so that it became a terrorist organization? And it's a scary thought, but it's happened to Islam, it could happen to us. Without people who can think, who can ethically decide, without people who have a sincere spirituality, any religion, including our own, can be hijacked to do the most abominable of things. That's the bad side. The good side is it's one of the things that I really love about my work at University of Notre Dame. It's what I loved about my work at Dallas. As many of you would know, and this is an advertisement from our sponsor, I know, but our core curriculum focuses on three things: God, moral decision-making, and the pursuit of truth, theology, ethics, and philosophy. And, you know, whether you do them at Notre Dame or another institution, it doesn't matter. But one of the things that the study of religious terrorism has told me is that it's through studies like that, theology, philosophy, and ethics, that we can influence our worlds and form minds and hearts that determine that things like terrorism are not the will of God, but something repugnant. And I hold firmly that an understanding of philosophy, theology, and ethics will not only influence others in their decisions about terrorism, but properly studied can help prevent our own society from falling into an abyss such as that of religious terrorism. I want to thank everyone from the Dawson Society, especially Tom Goulet, for your very kind hospitality tonight. thank you all for coming and making this a great evening. God bless you and have a great night. Thank you so much.
That was Professor Matthew Ogilvy with Religion and Terrorism. For more, visit DawsonSociety.com.au or cradio.org.au.